characteristic of deep learning is that it can find interesting features in the training data on its own without any need for manual feature engineering. And this can only be achieved when lots of training examples are available. This is especially true for problems where the input samples are very high dimensional, like images. But what constitutes lots of samples is relative. Relative to the size and depth of the network you're trying to train, for starters. It isn't possible to train a ConvNet to solve a complex problem with just a few tens of samples. But a few hundred can potentially suffice if the model is small and well regularized, and the task is simple. Because ConvNets can learn local translation invariant features, they're highly data efficient on perceptual problems. Training a ConvNet from scratch on a very small image dataset will still yield reasonable results despite a relative lack of data, without the need for any custom feature engineering. You'll see this in action in this section. What's more, deep learning models are by nature highly repurposable. You can take, say, an image classification or speech-to-text model trained on a large-scale dataset and reuse it on a significantly different problem with only minor changes. Specifically, in the case of computer vision, many pre-trained models, usually trained on the ImageNet dataset, are now publicly available for download and can be used to bootstrap powerful vision models out of very little data. That's what you'll do in the next section. Let's start by getting your hands on the data. Section 5.2.2. Downloading the data. The dogs versus cats dataset that you'll use isn't packaged with Keras. It was made available by Kaggle as part of a computer vision competition in late 2013, back when ConvNets weren't mainstream. You can download the original dataset from this URL. You'll need to create a Kaggle account if you don't already have one. Don't worry, the process is painless. The pictures are medium resolution color JPEGs. Figure 5.8 shows some examples. Unsurprisingly, the Dogs vs. Cats Kaggle competition in 2013 was won by entrants who used ConvNets. The best entries achieved up to 95% accuracy. In this example, you'll get fairly close to this accuracy in the next section, even though you'll train your models on less than 10% of the data that was available to the competitors. This dataset contains 25,000 images of dogs and cats, 12,500 from each class, and is 543 megabytes compressed. After downloading and uncompressing it, you'll create a new dataset containing three subsets. A training set with 1,000 samples of each class, a validation set with 500 samples of each class, and a test set with 500 samples of each class. Following is the code to do this. As a sanity check, let's count how many pictures are in each training split. Train versus validation versus test. So you do indeed have 2,000 training images, 1,000 validation images, and 1,000 test images. Each split contains the same number of samples from each class. This is a balanced binary classification problem, which means classification accuracy will be an appropriate measure of success. Section 5.2.3. Building your network. You built a small ConvNet for MNIST in the previous example, so you should be familiar with such ConvNets. You'll reuse the same general structure. The ConvNet will be a stack of alternated Conv2D with ReLU activation and max pooling 2D layers. But because you're dealing with bigger images and a more complex problem, you'll make your network larger accordingly. It will have one more Conv2D plus max pooling 2D stage. This serves both to augment the capacity of the network and to further reduce the size of the feature maps so they aren't overly large when you reach the flatten layer. Here, because you start from inputs of size 150 by 150, a somewhat arbitrary choice, you end up with feature maps of size 7x7, just before the flattened layer. Note, the depth of the feature maps progressively increases in the network from 32 to 128, whereas the size of the feature maps decreases from 150x150 to 7x7. This is a pattern you'll see in almost all ConvNets. Because you're attacking a binary classification problem, you'll end the network with a single unit, a dense layer of size 1, and a sigmoid activation. This unit will encode the probability that the network is looking at one class or the other. Let's look at how the dimensions of the feature maps change with every successive layer. For the compilation step, you'll go with the RMS prop optimizer as usual. Because you ended the network with a single sigmoid unit, you use binary cross entropy as a loss. As a reminder, check out table 4.1 for a cheat sheet on what loss function to use in various situations. Section 5.2.4. Data pre-processing. As you know by now, data should be formatted into appropriately pre-processed floating point tensors before being fed into the network. Currently, the data sits on a drive as JPEG files. So, the steps for getting it into the network are roughly as follows. Read the picture files. Decode the JPEG content to RGB grids of pixels. Convert these into floating point tensors. Rescale the pixel values between 0 and 255 to the 0 to 1 interval. As you know, neural networks prefer to deal with small input values. It may seem a bit daunting, but fortunately Keras has utilities to take care of these steps automatically. Keras has a module with image processing helper tools, located at keras.preprocessing.image. In particular, it contains the class ImageDataGenerator, which lets you quickly set up Python generators that can automatically turn image files on disk into batches of preprocessed tensors. This is what you'll use here. Understanding Python generators. A Python generator is an object that acts as an iterator. It's an object that you can use with the for something in operator. Generators are built using the yield operator. Here's an example of a generator that yields integers. It prints this. Let's look at the output of one of these generators. It yields batches of 150 by 150 RGB images, shape 20 by 150 by 150 by 3, and binary labels, shape 20. There are 20 samples in each batch, the batch size. Note that the generator yields these batches indefinitely. It loops endlessly over the images in the target folder. For this reason, you need to break the iteration loop at some point. Let's fit the model to the data using the generator. You do so using the fit_generator method. It's the equivalent of fit for data generators like this one. It expects, as its first argument, a Python generator that will yield batches of inputs and targets indefinitely, like this one does. Because the data is being generated endlessly, the Keras model needs to know how many samples to draw from the generator before declaring an epoch over. This is the role of the steps per epoch argument. After having drawn steps per epoch batches from the generator, that is, after having run 4 steps per epoch gradient descent steps, the fitting process will go to the next epoch. In this case, batches are 20 samples, so it will take 100 batches until you see your target of 2,000 samples. When using fit_generator, you can pass a validation_data argument, much as with the fit method. It's important to note that this argument is allowed to be a data generator, but it could also be a tuple of NumPy arrays. If you pass a generator as validation_data, then this generator is expected to yield batches of validation data endlessly. Thus, you should also specify the validation_steps argument, which tells the process how many batches to draw from the validation generator for evaluation. It's good practice to always save your models after training. Let's plot the loss and accuracy of the model over the training and validation data during training. See figures 5.9 and 5.10. These plots are characteristic of overfitting. The training accuracy increases linearly over time until it reaches nearly 100%, whereas the validation accuracy stalls at 70 to 72%. The validation loss reaches its maximum after only 5 epochs and then stalls, whereas the training loss keeps decreasing linearly until it reaches nearly zero. Because you have relatively few training samples, 2,000, overfitting will be your number one concern. You already know about a number of techniques that can help mitigate overfitting, such as dropout and weight decay, L2 regularization. We're now going to work with a new one, specific to computer vision, and used almost universally when processing images with deep learning models. Data augmentation. Section 5.2.5. Using data augmentation. Overfitting is caused by having too few samples to learn from, rendering you unable to train a model that can generalize to new data. Given infinite data, your model would be exposed to every possible aspect of the data distribution at hand. You would never overfit. Data augmentation takes the approach of generating more training data from existing training samples by augmenting the samples via a number of random transformations that yield believable-looking images. The goal is that, at training time, your model will never see the exact same picture twice. This helps expose the model to more aspects of the data and generalize better. In Keras, this can be done by configuring a number of random transformations to be performed on the images read by the image data generator instance. Let's get started with an example. These are just a few of the options available. For more, see the Keras documentation. Let's quickly go over this code. Rotation underscore range is a value in degrees, 0 to 180, a range within which to randomly rotate pictures. Width underscore shift and height underscore shift are ranges, as a fraction of total width or height, within which to randomly translate pictures vertically or horizontally. Shear underscore range is for randomly applying shearing transformations. Zoom underscore range is for randomly zooming inside pictures. Horizontal underscore flip is for randomly flipping half the images horizontally, relevant when there are no assumptions of horizontal asymmetry, for example, real-world pictures. Fill underscore mode is the strategy used for filling in newly created pixels which can appear after a rotation or a width or height shift. Let's look at the augmented images. See figure 5.11. If you train a new network using this data augmentation configuration, the network will never see the same input twice. But the inputs it sees are still heavily intercorrelated, because they come from a small number of original images. You can't produce new information, you can only remix existing information. As such, this may not be enough to completely get rid of overfitting. To further fight overfitting, you'll also add a dropout layer to your model right before the densely connected classifier. Let's train the network using data augmentation and dropout. Let's save the model. You'll use it in section 5.4. And let's plot the results again. See figures 5.12 and 5.13. Thanks to data augmentation and dropout, you're no longer overfitting. The training curves are closely tracking the validation curves. You now reach an accuracy of 82%, a 15% relative improvement over the non-regularized model. By using regularization techniques even further, and by tuning the network's parameters, such as the number of filters per convolution layer or the number of layers in the network, you may be able to get even better accuracy, likely up to 86% or 87%. But it would prove difficult to go any higher just by training your own ConvNet from scratch, because you have so little data to work with. As a next step to improve your accuracy on this problem, you'll have to use a pre-trained model, which is the focus of the next two sections. Section 5.3. Using a pre-trained ConvNet. A common, highly effective approach to deep learning on small image datasets is to use a pre-trained network. A pre-trained network is a safe network that was previously trained on a large dataset, typically on a large-scale image classification task. If this original dataset is large enough and general enough, then the spatial hierarchy of features learnt by the pre-trained network can effectively act as a generic model of the visual world, and hence its features can prove useful for many different computer vision problems, even though these new problems may involve completely different classes than those of the original task. For instance, you might train a network on ImageNet, where classes are mostly animals and everyday objects, and then repurpose this trained network for something as remote as identifying furniture items in images. Such portability of learned features across different problems is a key advantage of deep learning compared to many older, shallow learning approaches, and it makes deep learning very effective for small data problems. In this case, let's consider a large ConvNet trained on the ImageNet dataset, 1.4 million labeled images and 1,000 different classes. ImageNet contains many animal classes, including different species of cats and dogs. And you can thus expect it to perform well on the dogs versus cats classification problem. You'll use the VGG16 architecture, developed by Karen Simonian and Andrew Zisserman in 2014. It's a simple and widely used ConvNet architecture for ImageNet. Although it's an older model, far from the current state of the art, and somewhat heavier than many other recent models, I chose it because its architecture is similar to what you're already familiar with, and is easy to understand without introducing any new concepts. This may be your first encounter with one of these cutesy model names. VGG, ResNet, Inception, Inception ResNet, Exception, and so on. You'll get used to them, because they'll come up frequently if you keep doing deep learning for computer vision. Footnote: Karen Simonian and Andrew Zisserman, Very Deep Convolutional Networks for Large-Scale Image Recognition, ArcSci 2014. See this URL. There are two ways to use a pre-trained network: feature extraction and fine-tuning. We'll cover both of them. Let's start with feature extraction. Section 5.3.1. Feature extraction. Feature extraction consists of using the representations learned by a previous network to extract interesting features from new samples. These features are then run through a new classifier, which is trained from scratch. As you saw previously, ConvNets used for image classification comprise two parts. They start with a series of pooling and convolution layers, and they end with a densely connected classifier. The first part is called the convolutional base of the model. In the case of ConvNets, feature extraction consists of taking the convolutional base of a previously trained network, running the new data through it, and training a new classifier on top of the output. See figure 5.14. Why only reuse the convolutional base? Could you reuse the densely connected classifier as well? In general, doing so should be avoided. The reason is that the representations learned by the convolutional base are likely to be more generic and therefore more reusable. The feature maps of a ConvNet are presence maps of generic concepts over a picture, which is likely to be useful regardless of the computer vision problem at hand. But the representations learned by the classifier will necessarily be specific to the set of classes on which the model was trained. They will only contain information about the presence probability of this or that class in the entire picture. Additionally, representations found in densely connected layers no longer contain any information about where objects are located in the input image. These layers get rid of the notion of space, whereas the object location is still described by the convolutional feature maps. For problems where the object location matters, densely connected features are largely useless. Note that the level of generality, and therefore reusability, of the representations extracted by specific convolution layers depends on the depth of the layer in the model. Layers that come earlier in the model extract local, highly generic feature maps, such as visual edges, colors, and textures, whereas layers that are higher up extract more abstract concepts, such as cat ear or dog eye. So, if your new dataset differs a lot from the dataset on which the original model was trained, you may be better off using only the first few layers of the model to do feature extraction, rather than the entire convolutional base. In this case, because the ImageNet class set contains multiple dog and cat classes, it's likely to be beneficial to reuse the information contained in the densely connected layers of the original model. But we'll choose not to, in order to cover the more general case where the class set of the new problem doesn't overlap the class set of the original model. Let's put this in practice by using the convolutional base of the VGG16 network, trained on ImageNet, to extract interesting features from cat and dog images, and then train a dog versus cat classifier on top of these features. The VGG16 model, among others, comes prepackaged with Keras. You can import it from the keras.applications module. Here's the list of the image classification models, all pre-trained on the ImageNet dataset, that are available as part of keras.applications. Let's instantiate the VGG16 model. You pass three arguments to the constructor. Weights specifies the weight checkpoint from which to initialize the model. Include underscore top refers to including, or not, the densely connected classifier on top of the network. By default, this densely connected classifier corresponds to the 1,000 classes from ImageNet. Because you intend to use your own densely connected classifier, with only two classes, cat and dog, you don't need to include it. Input underscore shape is the shape of the image tensors that you'll feed to the network. This argument is purely optional. If you don't pass it, the network will be able to process inputs of any size. Here's the detail of the architecture of the VGG16 convolutional base. It's similar to the simple ConvNet you're already familiar with. The final feature map has shape 4x4x512. That's the feature on top of which you'll stick a densely connected classifier. At this point, there are two ways you could proceed. Running the convolutional base over your dataset, recording its output to a NumPy array on disk, and then using this data as input to a standalone, densely connected classifier similar to those you saw in part one of this book. This solution is fast and cheap to run because it only requires running the convolutional base once for every input image, and the convolutional base is by far the most expensive part of the pipeline. But for the same reason, this technique won't allow you to use data augmentation. Extending the model you have, conv underscore base, by adding dense layers on top and running the whole thing end-to-end on the input data. This will allow you to use data augmentation because every input image goes through the same convolutional base every time it's seen by the model. But for the same reason, this technique is far more expensive than the first. We'll cover both techniques. Let's walk through the code required to set up the first one, recording the output of conv underscore base on your data and using these outputs as inputs to a new model. Fast feature extraction without data augmentation. You'll start by running instances of the previously introduced image data generator to extract images as NumPy arrays as well as their labels. You'll extract features from these images by calling the predict model of the conv underscore base model. The extracted features are currently of shape samples by 4x4x512. You'll feed them to a densely connected classifier, so first you must flatten them to samples by 8192. At this point, you can define your densely connected classifier. Note the use of dropout for regularization, and train it on the data and labels that you just recorded. Training is very fast because you only have to deal with two dense layers. An epoch takes less than 1 second even on CPU. Let's look at the loss and accuracy curves during training. See figures 5.15 and 5.16. You reach a validation accuracy of about 90%, much better than you achieved in the previous section with a small model trained from scratch. But the plots also indicate that you're overfitting almost from the start, despite using dropout with a fairly large rate. That's because this technique doesn't use data augmentation, which is essential for preventing overfitting with small image datasets. Feature extraction with data augmentation. Now let's review the second technique I mentioned for doing feature extraction, which is much slower and more expensive, but which allows you to use data augmentation during training. Extending the conv underscore base model and running it end-to-end on the inputs. Note, this technique is so expensive that you should only attempt it if you have access to a GPU. It's absolutely intractable on CPU. If you can't run your code on GPU, then the previous technique is the way to go. Because models behave just like layers, you can add a model, like conv underscore base, to a sequential model, just like you would add a layer. This is what the model looks like now. As you can see, the convolutional base of VGG16 has 14,714,688 parameters, which is very large. The classifier you're adding on top has 2 million parameters. Before you compile and train the model, it's very important to freeze the convolutional base. Freezing a layer or set of layers means preventing their weights from being updated during training. If you don't do this, then the representations that were previously learned by the convolutional base will be modified during training. Because the dense layers on top are randomly initialized, very large weight updates would be propagated through the network, effectively destroying the representations previously learned. In Keras, you freeze a network by setting its trainable attribute to false. With this setup, only the weights from the two dense layers that you added will be trained. That's a total of 4 weight tensors, 2 per layer, the main weight matrix and the bias vector. Note that in order for these changes to take effect, you must first compile the model. If you ever modify weight trainability after compilation, you should then recompile the model, or these changes will be ignored. Now you can start training your model with the same data augmentation configuration that you used in the previous example. Let's plot the results again. See figures 5.17 and 5.18. As you can see, you reach a validation accuracy of about 96%. This is much better than you achieved with the small ConvNet trained from scratch. Section 5.3.2. Fine-tuning. Another widely used technique for model reuse, complementary to feature extraction, is fine-tuning. See figure 5.19. Fine-tuning consists of unfreezing a few of the top layers of a frozen model base used for feature extraction, and jointly training both the newly added part of the model, in this case the fully connected classifier, and these top layers. This is called fine-tuning because it slightly adjusts the more abstract representations of the model being reused in order to make them more relevant for the problem at hand. I stated earlier that it's necessary to freeze the convolutional base of VGG16 in order to be able to train a randomly initialized classifier on top. For the same reason, it's only possible to fine-tune the top layers of the convolutional base once the classifier on top has already been trained. If the classifier isn't already trained, then the error signal propagating through the network during training will be too large, and the representations previously learned by the layers being fine-tuned will be destroyed. Thus, the steps for fine-tuning a network are as follows. Add your custom network on top of an already trained base network. Freeze the base network. Train the part you added. Unfreeze some layers in the base network. Jointly train both these layers and the part you added. You already completed the first 3 steps when doing feature extraction. Let's proceed with step 4. You'll unfreeze your conv underscore base and then freeze individual layers inside it. As a reminder, this is what your convolutional base looks like. You'll fine-tune the last 3 convolutional layers, which means all layers up to block 4 underscore pool should be frozen, and the layers block 5 underscore conv 1, block 5 underscore conv 2, and block 5 underscore conv 3 should be trainable. Why not fine-tune more layers? Why not fine-tune the entire convolutional base? You could, but you need to consider the following. Earlier layers in the convolutional base encode more generic, reusable features, whereas layers higher up encode more specialized features. It's more useful to fine-tune the more specialized features because these are the ones that need to be repurposed on your new problem. There would be fast decreasing returns in fine-tuning lower layers. The more parameters you're training, the more you're at risk of overfitting. The convolutional base has 15 million parameters, so it would be risky to attempt to train it on your small dataset. Thus, in this situation, it's a good strategy to fine-tune only the top 2 or 3 layers in the convolutional base. Let's set this up, starting from where you left off in the previous example. Now you can begin fine-tuning the network. You'll do this with the RMS Prop Optimizer using a very low learning rate. The reason for using a low learning rate is that you want to limit the magnitude of the modifications you make to the representations of the three layers you're fine-tuning. Updates that are too large may harm these representations. Let's plot the results using the same plotting code as before. See figures 5.20 and 5.21. These curves look noisy. To make them more readable, you can smooth them by replacing every loss and accuracy with exponential moving averages of these quantities. Here's a trivial utility function to do this. See figures 5.22 and 5.23. The validation accuracy curve looks much cleaner. You're seeing a nice 1% absolute improvement in accuracy from about 96% to above 97%. Note that the loss curve doesn't show any real improvement. In fact, it's deteriorating. You may wonder, how could accuracy stay stable or improve if the loss isn't decreasing? The answer is simple. What you display is an average of point-wise loss values. But what matters for accuracy is the distribution of the loss values, not their average, because accuracy is the result of a binary thresholding of the class probability predicted by the model. The model may still be improving, even if this isn't reflected in the average loss. You can now finally evaluate this model on the test data. Here you get a test accuracy of 97%. In the original Kaggle competition around this dataset, this would have been one of the top results. But using modern deep learning techniques, you managed to reach this result using only a small fraction of the training data available, about 10%. There is a huge difference between being able to train on 20,000 samples compared to 2,000 samples. Section 5.3.3. Wrapping up. Here's what you should take away from the exercises in the past two sections. ConvNets are the best type of machine learning models for computer vision tasks. It's possible to train one from scratch even on a very small dataset with decent results. On a small dataset, overfitting will be the main issue. Data augmentation is a powerful way to fight overfitting when you're working with image data. It's easy to reuse an existing ConvNet on a new dataset via feature extraction. This is a valuable technique for working with small image datasets. As a complement to feature extraction, you can use fine-tuning, which adapts to a new problem some of the representations previously learned by an existing model. This pushes performance a bit further. Now you have a solid set of tools for dealing with image classification problems, in particular with small datasets. Section 5.4. Visualizing what ConvNets learn. It's often said that deep learning models are black boxes, learning representations that are difficult to extract and present in a human-readable form. Although this is partially true for certain types of deep learning models, it's definitely not true for ConvNets. The representations learned by ConvNets are highly amenable to visualization, in large part because they're representations of visual concepts. Since 2013, a wide array of techniques have been developed for visualizing and interpreting these representations. We won't survey all of them, but we'll cover three of the most accessible and useful ones. Visualizing intermediate ConvNet outputs. Intermediate activations. Useful for understanding how successive ConvNet layers transform their input and for getting a first idea of the meaning of individual ConvNet filters. Visualizing ConvNet filters. Useful for understanding precisely what visual pattern or concept each filter in a ConvNet is receptive to. Visualizing heat maps of class activation in an image. Useful for understanding which parts of an image were identified as belonging to a given class, thus allowing you to localize objects in images. For the first method, activation visualization, you'll use the small ConvNet you trained from scratch on the dogs versus cats classification problem in section 5.2. For the next two methods, you'll use the VGG16 model introduced in Section 5.3. Section 5.4.1. Visualizing intermediate activations. Visualizing intermediate activations consists of displaying the feature maps that are output by various convolution and pooling layers in a network, given a certain input. The output of a layer is often called its activation, the output of the activation function. This gives a view into how an input is decomposed into the different filters learned by the network. You want to visualize feature maps with three dimensions, width, height, and depth channels. Each channel encodes relatively independent features, so the proper way to visualize these feature maps is by independently plotting the contents of every channel as a 2D image. Let's start by loading the model that you saved in Section 5.2. Next, you'll get an input image, a picture of a cat, not part of the images the network was trained on. Let's display the picture. See Figure 5.24. In order to extract the feature maps you want to look at, you'll create a Keras model that takes batches of images as inputs and outputs the activations of all convolution and pooling layers. To do this, you'll use the Keras class Model. A model is instantiated using two arguments, an input tensor, or list of input tensors, and an output tensor, or list of output tensors. The resulting class is a Keras model, just like the sequential models you're familiar with, mapping the specified inputs to the specified outputs. What sets the model class apart is it allows for models with multiple outputs, unlike sequential. For more information about the model class, see Section 7.1. When fed an image input, this model returns the values of the layer activations in the original model. This is the first time you've encountered a multi-output model in this book. Until now, the models you've seen have had exactly one input and one output. In the general case, a model can have any number of inputs and outputs. This one has one input and eight outputs. One output per layer activation. For instance, this is the activation of the first convolution layer for the cat image input. It's a 148 by 148 feature map with 32 channels. Let's try plotting the fourth channel of the activation of the first layer of the original model. See Figure 5.25. This channel appears to encode a diagonal edge detector. Let's try the seventh channel. See Figure 5.26. But note that your own channels may vary because the specific filters learned by convolution layers aren't deterministic. This one looks like a bright green dot detector, useful to encode cat eyes. At this point, let's plot a complete visualization of all the activations in the network. See Figure 5.27. You'll extract and plot every channel in each of the eight activation maps, and you'll stack the results in one big image tensor with channels stacked side by side. There are a few things to note here. The first layer acts as a collection of various edge detectors. At that stage, the activations retain almost all the information present in the initial picture. As you go higher, the activations become increasingly abstract and less visually interpretable. They begin to encode higher-level concepts such as cat ear and cat eye. Higher presentations carry increasingly less information about the visual contents of the image and increasingly more information related to the class of the image. The sparsity of the activations increases with the depth of the layer. In the first layer, all filters are activated by the input image, but in the following layers, more and more filters are blank. This means the pattern encoded by the filter isn't found in the input image. We have just evidenced an important universal characteristic of the representations learned by deep neural networks. The features extracted by a layer become increasingly abstract with the depth of the layer. The activations of higher layers carry less and less information about the specific input being seen, and more information about the target. In this case, the class of the image, cat or dog. A deep neural network effectively acts as an information distillation pipeline. With raw data going in this case, RGB pictures, and being repeatedly transformed so that irrelevant information is filtered out, for example, the specific visual appearance of the image, and useful information is magnified and refined, for example, the class of the image. After observing a scene for a few seconds, a human can remember which abstract objects were present in it, bicycle, tree, but can't remember the specific appearance of these objects. In fact, if you tried to draw a generic bicycle from memory, chances are you couldn't get it even remotely right, even though you've seen thousands of bicycles in your lifetime. See, for example, figure 5.28. Try it right now. This effect is absolutely real. Your brain has learnt to completely abstract its visual input, to transform it into high-level visual concepts, while filtering out irrelevant visual details, making it tremendously difficult to remember how things around you look. Section 5.4.2. Visualizing ConvNet filters. Another easy way to inspect the filters learned by ConvNets is to display the visual pattern that each filter is meant to respond to. This can be done with gradient ascent in input space. Applying gradient descent to the value of the input image of a ConvNet so as to maximize the response of a specific filter starting from a blank input image. The resulting input image will be one that the chosen filter is maximally responsive to. The process is simple. You'll build a loss function that maximizes the value of a given filter in a given convolution layer, and then you'll use stochastic gradient descent to adjust the values of the input image so as to maximize this activation value. For instance, here's a loss for the activation of filter 0 in the layer block3_conv1 of the VGG16 network, pre-trained on ImageNet. To implement gradient descent, you'll need the gradient of this loss with respect to the model's input. To do this, you'll use the gradients function, packaged with the back-end module of Keras. A non-obvious trick to use to help the gradient descent process go smoothly is to normalize the gradient tensor by dividing it by its L2 norm, the square root of the average of the square of the values in the tensor. This ensures that the magnitude of the updates done to the input image is always within the same range. Now you need a way to compute the value of the loss tensor and the gradient tensor given an input image. You can define a Keras backend function to do this. Iterate is a function that takes a NumPy tensor as a list of tensors of size 1 and returns a list of 2 NumPy tensors, the loss value and the gradient value. At this point, you can define a Python loop to do stochastic gradient descent. The resulting image tensor is a floating point tensor of shape 1 by 150 by 150 by 3 with values that may not be integers within 0 to 255. Hence, you need to post-process this tensor to turn it into a displayable image. You do so with the following straightforward utility function. Now you have all the pieces. Let's put them together into a Python function that takes as input a layer name and a filter index, and returns a valid image tensor representing the pattern that maximizes the activation of the specified filter. Let's try it. See figure 5.29. It seems that filter 0 in layer block3_conv1 is responsive to a polka dot pattern. Now the fun part. You can start visualizing every filter in every layer. For simplicity, you'll only look at the first 64 filters in each layer, and you'll only look at the first layer of each convolution block. Block1_conv1, block2_conv1, block3_conv1, block4_conv1, block5_conv1. You'll arrange the outputs on an 8x8 grid of 64x64 filter patterns, with some black margins between each filter pattern. See figures 5.30 to 5.33. These filter visualizations tell you a lot about how ConvNet layers see the world. Each layer in a ConvNet learns a collection of filters, such that their inputs can be expressed as a combination of the filters. This is similar to how the Fourier transform decomposes signals onto a bank of cosine functions. The filters in these ConvNet filter banks get increasingly complex and refined as you go higher in the model. The filters from the first layer in the model, block1_conv1, encode simple directional edges and colors, or colored edges in some cases. The filters from block2_conv1 encode simple textures made from combinations of edges and colors. The filters in higher layers begin to resemble textures found in natural images, feathers, eyes, leaves, and so on. Section 5.4.3, visualizing heat maps of class activation. I'll introduce one more visualization technique, one that is useful for understanding which parts of a given image led a ConvNet to its final classification decision. This is helpful for debugging the decision process of a ConvNet, particularly in the case of a classification mistake. It also allows you to locate specific objects in an image. This general category of techniques is called Class Activation Map, CAM, visualization, and it consists of producing heat maps of class activation over input images. A class activation heat map is a 2D grid of scores associated with a specific output class, computed for every location in an input image, indicating how important each location is with respect to the class under consideration. For instance, given an image fed into a dogs versus cats ConvNet, CAM visualization allows you to generate a heat map for the class cat, indicating how cat-like different parts of the image are, and also a heat map for the class dog, indicating how dog-like parts of the image are. The specific implementation you'll use is the one described in GRAD-CAM, Visual Explanations from Deep Networks via Gradient-Based Localization. It's very simple. It consists of taking the output feature map of a convolution layer, given an input image, and weighing every channel in that feature map by the gradient of the class with respect to the channel. Intuitively, one way to understand this trick is that you're weighing a spatial map of how intensely the input image activates different channels by how important each channel is with regard to the class, resulting in a spatial map of how intensely the input image activates the class. Footnote: Ramprasath R. Selvaraju et al., OxIV, 2017, at this URL. We'll demonstrate this technique using the pre-trained VGG16 network again. Consider the image of two African elephants shown in figure 5.34, under a Creative Commons license, possibly a mother and her calf, strolling on the savannah. Let's convert this image into something the VGG16 model can read. The model was trained on images of size 224 by 224, pre-processed according to a few rules that are packaged in the utility function keras.applications.vgg16.preprocess_input. So, you need to load the image, resize it to 224 by 224, convert it to a NumPy Float32 tensor, and apply these pre-processing rules. You can now run the pre-trained network on the image and decode its prediction vector back to a human-readable format. The top three classes predicted for this image are as follows: African elephant, with 92.5% probability; tusker, with 7% probability; Indian elephant, with 0.4% probability. The network has recognized the image as containing an undetermined quantity of African elephants. The entry in the prediction vector that was maximally activated is the one corresponding to the African elephant class at index 386. To visualize which parts of the image are the most African elephant-like, let's set up the GRAD-CAM process. For visualization purposes, you'll also normalize the heat map between 0 and 1. The result is shown in figure 5.35. Finally, you'll use OpenCV to generate an image that superimposes the original image on the heat map you just obtained. See figure 5.36. This visualization technique answers two important questions. Why did the network think this image contained an African elephant? Where is the African elephant located in the picture? In particular, it's interesting to note that the ears of the elephant calf are strongly activated. This is probably how the network can tell the difference between African and Indian elephants. Chapter Summary. ConvNets are the best tool for attacking visual classification problems. ConvNets work by learning a hierarchy of modular patterns and concepts to represent the visual world. The representations they learn are easy to inspect. ConvNets are the opposite of black boxes. You're now capable of training your own ConvNet from scratch to solve an image classification problem. You understand how to use visual data augmentation to fight overfitting. You know how to use a pre-trained ConvNet to do feature extraction and fine-tuning. You can generate visualizations of the filters learned by your ConvNets, as well as heat maps of class activity. Chapter 6. Deep Learning for Text and Sequences. This chapter covers pre-processing text data into useful representations, working with recurrent neural networks, using 1D ConvNets for sequence processing. This chapter explores deep learning models that can process text, understood as sequences of words or sequences of characters, time series, and sequence data in general. The two fundamental deep learning algorithms for sequence processing are recurrent neural networks and 1D ConvNets, the one-dimensional version of the 2D ConvNets that we covered in the previous chapters. We'll discuss both of these approaches in this chapter. Applications of these algorithms include the following: document classification and time series classification, such as identifying the topic of an article or the author of a book; time series comparisons, such as estimating how closely related two documents or two stock tickers are; sequence-to-sequence learning, such as decoding an English sentence into French; sentiment analysis, such as classifying the sentiment of tweets or movie reviews as positive or negative; time series forecasting, such as predicting the future weather at a certain location given recent weather data. This chapter's examples focus on two narrow tasks: sentiment analysis on the IMDb dataset, a task we approached earlier in the book, and temperature forecasting. But the techniques demonstrated for these two tasks are relevant to all the applications just listed, and many more. Section 6.1. Working with text data. Text is one of the most widespread forms of sequence data. It can be understood as either a sequence of characters or a sequence of words, but is most common to work at the level of words. The deep learning sequence processing models introduced in the following sections can use text to produce a basic form of natural language understanding, sufficient for applications including document classification, sentiment analysis, author identification, and even question answering, QA, in a constrained context. Of course, keep in mind throughout this chapter that none of these deep learning models truly understand text in a human sense. Rather, these models can map the statistical structure of written language, which is sufficient to solve many simple textual tasks. Deep learning for natural language processing is pattern recognition applied to words, sentences, and paragraphs in much the same way that computer vision is pattern recognition applied to pixels. Like all other neural networks, deep learning models don't take as input raw text. They only work with numeric tensors. Vectorizing text is the process of transforming text into numeric tensors. This can be done in multiple ways. Segment text into words and transform each word into a vector. Segment text into characters and transform each character into a vector. Extract n-grams of words or characters and transform each n-gram into a vector. N-grams are overlapping groups of multiple consecutive words or characters. Collectively, the different units into which you can break down text, words, characters, or n-grams, are called tokens. And breaking text into such tokens is called tokenization. All text vectorization processes consist of applying some tokenization scheme and then associating numeric vectors with the generated tokens. These vectors, packed into sequence tensors, are fed into deep neural networks. There are multiple ways to associate a vector with a token. In this section, I'll present two major ones: one-hot encoding of tokens and token embedding, typically used exclusively for words and called word embedding. The remainder of this section explains these techniques and shows how to use them to go from raw text to a NumPy tensor that you can send to a Keras network. Understanding n-grams and bag of words. Word n-grams are groups of n or fewer consecutive words that you can extract from a sentence. The same concept may also be applied to characters instead of words. Here's a simple example. Consider the sentence, "The cat sat on the mat." It may be decomposed into the following set of 2 grams. It may also be decomposed into the following set of 3 grams. Such a set is called a bag of 2 grams or bag of 3 grams respectively. The term bag here refers to the fact you're dealing with a set of tokens rather than a list or sequence. The tokens have no specific order. This family of tokenization methods is called bag of words. Because bag of words isn't an order-preserving tokenization method, the tokens generated are understood as a set, not a sequence, and the general structure of the sentence is lost. It tends to be used in shallow language processing models rather than in deep learning models. Extracting n-grams is a form of feature engineering, and deep learning does away with this kind of rigid, brittle approach, replacing it with hierarchical feature learning. One-dimensional convnets and recurrent neural networks, introduced later in this chapter, are capable of learning representations for groups of words and characters without being explicitly told about the existence of such groups, by looking at continuous word or character sequences. For this reason, we won't cover n-grams any further in this book. But do keep in mind that they're a powerful, unavoidable feature engineering tool when using lightweight, shallow text processing models such as logistic regression and random forests. Section 6.1.1. One-hot encoding of words and characters. One-hot encoding is the most common, most basic way to turn a token into a vector. You saw it in action in the initial IMDb and Reuters examples in Chapter 3, done with words in that case. It consists of associating a unique integer index with every word and then turning this integer index I into a binary vector of size n, the size of the vocabulary. The vector is all zeros except for the ith entry, which is 1. Of course, one-hot encoding can be done at the character level as well. To unambiguously drive home what one-hot encoding is and how to implement it, listings 6.1 and 6.2 show 2 toy examples, one for words, the other for characters. Note that Keras has built-in utilities for doing one-hot encoding of text at the word level or character level, starting from raw text data. You should use these utilities because they take care of a number of important features, such as stripping special characters from strings and only taking into account the n most common words in your dataset. A common restriction, to avoid dealing with very large input vector spaces. A variant of one-hot encoding is the so-called one-hot hashing trick, which you can use when the number of unique tokens in your vocabulary is too large to handle explicitly. Instead of explicitly assigning an index to each word and keeping a reference of these indices in a dictionary, you can hash words into vectors of fixed size. This is typically done with a very lightweight hashing function. The main advantage of this method is it does away with maintaining an explicit word index, which saves memory and allows online encoding of the data. You can generate token vectors right away, before you've seen all of the available data. The one drawback of this approach is that it's susceptible to hash collisions. 2 different words may end up with the same hash, and subsequently any machine learning model looking at these hashes won't be able to tell the difference between these words. The likelihood of hash collisions decreases when the dimensionality of the hashing space is much larger than the total number of unique tokens being hashed. Section 6.1.2. Using word embeddings. Another popular and powerful way to associate a vector with a word is the use of dense word vectors, also called word embeddings. Whereas the vectors obtained through one-hot encoding are binary, sparse, mostly made of zeros, and very high-dimensional, same dimensionality as the number of words in the vocabulary, word embeddings are low-dimensional floating-point vectors, that is, dense vectors, as opposed to sparse vectors. See Figure 6.2. Unlike the word vectors obtained via one-hot encoding, word embeddings are learned from data. It's common to see word embeddings that are 256-dimensional, 512-dimensional, or 1024-dimensional when dealing with very large vocabularies. On the other hand, one-hot encoding generally leads to vectors that are 20,000-dimensional or greater, capturing a vocabulary of 20,000 tokens in this case. So, word embeddings pack more information into far fewer dimensions. There are two ways to obtain word embeddings. Learn word embeddings jointly with the main task you care about, such as document classification or sentiment prediction. In this setup, you start with random word vectors and then learn word vectors in the same way you learn the weights of the neural network. Load into your model word embeddings that were pre-computed using a different machine learning task than the one you're trying to solve. These are called pre-trained word embeddings. Let's look at both. Learning word embeddings with the embedding layer. The simplest way to associate a dense vector with a word is to choose the vector at random. The problem with this approach is that the resulting embedding space has no structure. For instance, the words accurate and exact may end up with completely different embeddings, even though they're interchangeable in most sentences. It's difficult for a deep neural network to make sense of such a noisy, unstructured embedding space. To get a bit more abstract, the geometric relationship between word vectors should reflect the semantic relationship between these words. Word embeddings are meant to map human language into a geometric space. For instance, in a reasonable embedding space, you would expect synonyms to be embedded into similar word vectors. In general, you would expect the geometric distance, such as L2 distance, between any two word vectors to relate to the semantic distance between the associated words. Words meaning different things are embedded at points far away from each other, whereas related words are closer. In addition to distance, you may want specific directions in the embedding space to be meaningful. To make this clearer, let's look at a concrete example. In Figure 6.3, four words are embedded on a 2D plane: cat, dog, wolf, and tiger. With the vector representations we choose here, some semantic relationships between these words can be encoded as geometric transformations. For instance, the same vector allows us to go from cat to tiger and from dog to wolf. This vector could be interpreted as the from pet to wild animal vector. Similarly, another vector lets us go from dog to cat and from wolf to tiger, which could be interpreted as a from canine to feline vector. In real-world word embedding spaces, common examples of meaningful geometric transformations are gender vectors and plural vectors. For instance, by adding a female vector to the vector king, we obtain the vector queen. By adding a plural vector, we obtain kings. Word embedding spaces typically feature thousands of such interpretable and potentially useful vectors. Is there some ideal word embedding space that would perfectly map human language and could be used for any natural language processing task? Possibly. But we have yet to compute anything of the sort. Also, there is no such thing as a human language. There are many different languages, and they aren't isomorphic, because a language is a reflection of a specific culture and a specific context. But more pragmatically, what makes a good word embedding space depends heavily on your task. the perfect word embedding space for an English language movie review sentiment analysis model may look different from the perfect embedding space for an English language legal document classification model, because the importance of certain semantic relationships varies from task to task. It is thus reasonable to learn a new embedding space with every new task. Fortunately, backpropagation makes this easy. And Keras makes it even easier. It's about learning the weights of a layer, the embedding layer. The embedding layer is best understood as a dictionary that maps integer indices, which stand for specific words, to dense vectors. It takes integers as input, it looks up these integers in an internal dictionary, and it returns the associated vectors. It's effectively a dictionary lookup. See figure 6.4. The embedding layer takes as input a 2D tensor of integers of shape samples by sequence underscore length, where each entry is a sequence of integers. It can embed sequences of variable lengths. For instance, you could feed into the embedding layer in the previous example batches with shapes 32 by 10, batches of 32 sequences of length 10, or